Let's start in Mark chapter 14. Mark 14. This chapter is on Tuesday of the week that Jesus is crucified. It's Passover week in Jerusalem, the biggest week of the year on the Jewish calendar. Jesus is in a bedroom community of Jerusalem in this chapter, Bethany, where he often resorted. He typically would be in the house of Martha, in the home of Mary, Martha, and Lazarus when he's in Bethany, but not in this chapter. He's in another house in Bethany that belongs to a man identified as Simon the leper. Now, normally, lepers did not host banquets because no one could associate with them because they were contagious. So, since this man is having people into his home, he is no longer a leper. And there was no cure for leprosy. So that tells us that he had previously met Jesus, who is the only one who could cure leprosy. And perhaps this meal is in honor of Jesus, in appreciation for his healing. Now, Simon is there. Jesus is there. The apostles are there. Mary, Martha, and Lazarus are there, according to John 12, which is the parallel passage. And on this occasion, something happens to Jesus that, as far as we know, only happened one other time, which is recorded in Luke 7, a different instance. But here we have Jesus being anointed with oil. An alabaster box of ointment is broken and poured on his head. Now let's look at an overview quickly, if you like to sort of see where we're going in a lesson. This lesson or this section has three parts. You have the compassion of Mary, which is verse 3. And then you have the criticism of the apostles, verses 4 and 5. And then you have the compliment of Jesus, verses 6 through 9. Each of those teaches us a great lesson. We're going to focus primarily in this sermon on Mary breaking the alabaster box. And then on Wednesday night, we will follow up in the parallel chapter, John 12, and talk about five different people at this banquet, and each one of them has a lesson. Those won't overlap much. We will say what we say in this lesson and hold the rest of it until we get to Wednesday night. Let's begin reading in verse 3, talk about the compassion of Mary. Now, what we want to see out of this is that Mary is an example for each of us. In fact, Jesus said that wherever the gospel is preached, that this incident in his life would be promoted or would be preached on. Verse 9, here we are about 1,990 years removed from when this happened, about 6,000 miles away. And yet, we're still talking about Mary breaking the alabaster box of ointment. Because Jesus wanted us to know her story, Jesus wanted us to treat him like she treated him, to learn from him, from her, what a follower of him, of Jesus, how much a follower of Jesus should value that relationship. And that's where we are. Now, if you want to sum up Mary's lesson, if you don't get anything else out of the lesson, just remember this sentence. Hopefully you'll get more than one thing, but at least this. Mary did what she could, when she could, and spared no expense. I'll say that again. Mary did what she could, when she could, and spared no expense. Now that's the lesson of Mary. Let's see the details of it, beginning in verse 3, and being in Bethany in the house of Simon the leper as he sat at meat. Now, so they're having a meal. Meat in the King James is just a meal. And they didn't have tables like we have that are waist high and you sit with your feet under the table flat on the floor. They had short tables about 18 inches tall. And they had cushions or pillows around them. And so you would recline with your feet away from the table, prop up on an elbow, and then eat with the other hand. So picture Jesus at this table with others. I guess he's right beside Simon, who would be the host. and then maybe his apostles around. And the door, I see the door behind Jesus. Mary coming in, maybe. Now, Mary's not identified in Mark as the woman. It's just a woman in Mark. But John tells us it's Mary, the sister of Lazarus and Martha. So we know who she is, even though she's not identified here. So Mary comes in. I see her coming in, maybe behind Jesus. Jesus is busy talking with others. And then he feels something running down his face, something on his head. And he's like, ooh. You know, there's this ointment. Now, hold that thought for a minute, and let's back up and see how this played out. She comes up behind him with an alabaster box, King James has. You may have a translation that has something else. It probably would be best rendered as a flask in our language. But the key thing is that it was hermetically sealed so that it didn't have a reusable top. It had a long neck, and then when it was manufactured, it was closed with the ointment inside so that in order to get the contents out, you broke the neck of the flask or the box, and then you couldn't put it back together. So you had to use the contents at the same time you opened it. Now, the reason for that is because they didn't use this like we use perfume or deodorant. This wasn't a daily use kind of thing. This was a family investment kind of thing. In fact, many people would use these for retirement funds or emergency funds. In those days, well, really throughout the entire history of God's people in Jerusalem, they were invaded often. And so armies would come in and you might not have much warning. And you would have to flee. Like if you were outside the city, generally you would flee in behind the wall of the city, or sometimes you might flee away into the wilderness or maybe even to another city, and you would have to have some funds to support yourself. So they would invest their funds generally in clothing, like an embroidered robe or garment that could be taken, folded up, and carried with them at a moment's notice, or they would put the funds into an alabaster box of ointment. If you didn't ever need it, you would just hand it down to your child and then to their children and so forth like that. So picture that as what is happening here. Now, I see Mary as going into her house thinking, well, this text tells us that Jesus had been telling them, which we knew from other passages such as Matthew 16, 21 and following, Jesus has been telling them for a while that he was going to die, that they were going to execute him. Now, the disciples didn't let that register. In fact, when they first heard it, Peter rebuked the Lord and said, "Not so, Lord." And Jesus rebuked him and called him Satan when he said that. But Mary heard the same thing and she believed it. She accepted it. And so she goes into her house, at least I picture it this way, thinking, what can I give him? How can I express my feelings for Jesus? Now remember, he also raised her brother from the dead, Lazarus. After they had buried him, he came back. And so she has her brother back. Every time she sees him, she thinks, if it hadn't been for Jesus, I wouldn't have my brother. So she has a lot of reasons to love Jesus. She goes into her house perhaps and thinks, what could I give him? Maybe she sees that. No, that wouldn't be enough. And then something else. No, a woman probably shouldn't give that to a man. And then she said, thought, maybe I could give him that alabaster. No, that's too expensive. We're saving that for a rainy day. I mean, that's our family investment. And then she thought, well, what am I ever going to use it for that's more important than this? Who could I ever give it to that means more to me than Jesus does? And so perhaps she went into wherever they had it hidden in the house, pulled it out, walked down the street, and I see her with tunnel vision. You know, she walks into that room, and the only person in the room to her is Jesus. She walks right up to him. She breaks it and pours it on his head. And then Jesus, as we saw a minute ago, and he turns around. May I ask you what countenance he has when he sees "Oh, it's Mary." Could it be anything but a smile? Could it be anything but thanksgiving? "Mary, what have you done?" What a thoughtful gesture. He says that toward the end of this section, "She hath anointed me for my burial." So have you heard the saying, you know, my kids laugh at my old people sayings, you know, so maybe you don't know this saying, but have you ever heard the saying or used it, "Give me my flowers while I live"? That's what Mary is doing here. You know, you could put flowers on a casket and it will benefit the family, the friends, but the person in the casket is not going to be able to smell the flowers, not going to see the beauty of the flowers. And so Jesus' body will be anointed, washed and anointed and put on a bed of spices after He's dead, but He's not going to appreciate it at that time. But Mary gives Him His ointment while He can still appreciate it. Now Mary is expressing her love for Him by giving something that is so valuable that it says, "You mean the most to me of anybody." Now the disciples in this second section we're only going to touch on in this lesson, the disciples say that it could have been sold for 300 pence. It doesn't mean a lot to us because you probably have a jar or a drawer somewhere that has more than 300 pennies in it, right? So pennies aren't very valuable to us. But remember, that's a different economy than ours. And Matthew 20 verse 2 says that a man would work all day long and receive a penny for his labor. So that was the daily wage of a day laborer, a penny. So 300, take out the weekends, that's a year's salary. So substitute in that 300 pence spot in your mind whatever your annual salary is. And she poured that annual salary on Jesus' head. Now that gives it a different perspective, doesn't it? Now, let me go into the last section. The disciples criticize her. They say, "Why was this waste of the ointment made?" We'll talk about that more on Wednesday night. But I want to focus on what Jesus said here. Drop down to verse 6, Mark 14, 6, and said, "Let her alone." Let her alone. We would say, "Would you leave her alone? Why trouble ye her? Don't be a troublemaker." Some people seem to enjoy causing trouble, being at the center of controversy. That's not a godly person. Now, a godly person will fight for the cause of Christ. They will enter into a discussion, even a debate for truth, but it's not their joy. And it's not over an opinion. It's not over a judgment. It's not over something that's going to discourage and hurt rather than encourage and promote the gospel of Christ. And that's what the disciples were doing. They were criticizing a good deed. They said, "You're wasting this." But Jesus took the same event and evaluated it differently. Because He says in verse 6, "She hath wrought a wasteful work on me." Is that what your Bible says? "She hath wrought a good work on me." Disciples, that's a waste. Now you think about for a minute. Does Jesus know what they're saying? Yes, He's right there. He wouldn't even need to be there to know it, but He's right there. And so, I wonder what Jesus thought. "I'm not worth it? Is that what you're saying? This is a waste because she poured it on me. So I'm not worth it." Right, Judas? That's how much you evaluate or value our relationship? Value me? You see, to Mary, Jesus was worth her most priceless gift. To Judas, that was a waste. Is there anybody in your life who considers your contributions on Sundays? That's a waste. Why are you throwing that money away for? You know how much do you give in a year? You know what you could do with that? You know what you could do with a lot? You could have sent your child to college with that money you've given to the church while they've been, since your child was born. You could have them drive a nicer car than that car you're driving. You could go on some pretty good vacation. You see, it's a different priority scale, isn't it? It's this world, temporary, versus that world, eternal. Because every time we put something in the plate, we're making a deposit in heaven's bank, aren't we? Lay not up for yourselves treasures on earth, where moth and rust doth corrupt, where thieves break through and steal. But lay up for yourselves treasures in heaven, where neither moth nor rust doth corrupt, where thieves cannot break through and steal. For where your heart is, there where your treasure is, there will your heart be also. Matthew 6:19-21. So our hearts are already in heaven. And we're just sending our money over there a little bit at a time, right? So, well, we have a different valuation of everything than the world does. Because it's not about pleasure and power and politics. It's about Jesus. It's about souls. It's about salvation. It's about eternity. And Mary got it. And the disciples on this occasion missed it. Jesus says, she's wrought a good work on me. I'm in verse 6. Why trouble you her? Don't be a troublemaker. Leave her alone. Now, I want to encourage you, if anybody, and I know this would never happen to anybody in here, but if anybody ever were to criticize you, I'm being facetious, right? Don't raise your hand, but who's been criticized? Yeah, everybody in here has been criticized. Do you know this old saying? No good deed goes unpunished. Yeah. Have you ever done something good from good motives, out of love, because of the care, the responsibility, the duty, the requirements of your faith, and somebody criticizes you for that? Ever served as an elder and gave freely of your time, made a decision after weighing everything, and everybody always loves all the decisions, right? No, not every time. Ever preach a sermon? Put a lot of work and prayer into it, study, got, you know, from the depths of your heart, preach a lesson. Somebody gets you on the foyer and says, Yeah, maybe. You ever just do what you know you should do as a Christian at work and somebody stabs you in the back for it because you won't go along with their dishonesty perhaps? Yeah, we've all been there. So here, and we may face this again, and don't let it throw you off your game or your feet, because we should expect it. The devil's not going to leave us alone. God's people are always against the world. And the world's never going to love us. So don't expect that. But when you're criticized, just remember this passage. Leave her alone. What does the Lord say when you're criticized? Does He love you any less than He loved Mary? Now, don't answer that too hastily. Because the answer is no. He doesn't love you any less than Mary. You say, wait a minute, He knew Mary. That's not what I'm talking. I'm not talking about friendship. I'm talking about love. You know, Jesus loves every person as much as it's possible to be loved. You couldn't be loved any more by Jesus than you're loved. It's not possible, because He loves everybody all the way. Now, when you consider that, you mean as much to Him as Mary did. And when you're criticized for serving Him, He's going to do what He did for Mary. He's going to say, would you leave her alone? She's mine. Would you leave Him alone? He's just trying to do what I want Him to. Yeah. Now, you're not going to hear that. You're not going to know that tangibly, but just know it by faith that Jesus is saying, I'm on your side. I will defend you. You're mine. You keep on. That's why this is in here. That's why we're preaching about it 2,000 years later, 6,000 miles away, because Jesus told us to preach it. That's one of the lessons we ought to get out of this. And then he says, "Shall wrought a good work on me." You see, the "me" is important there. She didn't just pour this down the sink. She poured it on my head. So she wrought a good, she did it for me. Not for her glory. Not because she would get something out of it. She did it because she loves me. I remember years ago we had Posh in the pulpit in the early days in Alabama. We took a field trip over to Birmingham. It's about an hour and a half from where we were. We went to Roebuck Parkway Church of Christ. It doesn't even exist anymore. They've moved out to a different area and have a different name. But at that time, Jerry Jenkins preached there, and we wanted to learn from him. He had preached at that time in that congregation for 29 years. It had grown. In fact, during those 29 years, I think he ended up preaching there 34 years. I could be wrong about that number, but he wasn't in his last year. He averaged baptizing, or the church averaged baptizing a person a week for 29 years. We wanted to know how. So it was a very profitable day. And he made a couple of statements that I've remembered since, but one of them is this. He said, now this is a man who preached for a 600 member church, plus. He said, "I'm an introvert." I remember thinking, what? But I get it now. Now, introvert doesn't have to do with role. Has to do with whether you give energy or receive energy in personal interactions. So all of us are one or the other. You know, do you go home after Sunday? Sort of, I need some downtime. I'm all given out. And other people go home, oh yeah, boy, that was great. You know, people are just people. It doesn't matter which one you, but he said, "I'm an introvert." He said, "It's not natural for me to go up and talk to people." This is what he said that I remember. He said, "But I'll do things for Jesus I won't do for anybody else." He had a Bible study every week. What about me? She had done what she could. Could I do that? I'll do things for him I won't do for anybody else, because I love him the most. All right. The balance of our time. Do we have any time? What time am I supposed to finish? We have the Lord's Supper yet to go, right? Yeah. All right. Tell you what. Let me just make this point. I could preach the rest of the hour on this point, but I'll just make the point. Breaking the alabaster box means giving an extravagant gift. That's what it is. Now, Jesus is not here for you to pour expensive oil on His head. But what would be the equivalent of breaking the alabaster box today? Well, I just touched on service, evangelism. We'll talk more about that as the week goes along. But I want to make the application to what we're doing today. Worship. May I ask this? Does God deserve extravagant worship? Does He deserve the very best that I could give Him? Well, I see everyone nodding because there's no other answer to that. Every bite of food I've ever had came from Him. Every breath of air I ever enjoyed was from Him. Every blessing, James 1:17, is from Him. He gave His Son to die for me. He saved my soul. He is going to welcome me into heaven one day. Yes, He's deserving of the best whatever the pittance is that I could give in response to that, he's well deserving of it and more. All right. So what does God value? I don't know if you exchange gifts at the end of the year or not, but probably many people do. Is there anybody on your list that you always have a hard time finding something for? It's like, he has everything. And what he doesn't have, and he wanted it, he already went out and got it. You know, you ever got something for somebody and they bought it before you could give it to them? It's like, ah! Well, God is, so I say God is like that. Let me reword that. God has everything, right? He has a cattle on 1,000 hills. Psalm 50, 10 to 12. He has the hills under 1,000 cattle, for that matter. He owns the earth and the fullness thereof, Psalm 24, 1. So what can you give someone who has everything literally? I'll tell you. And there is an answer. Yourself. If you don't give yourself, he doesn't have it. He doesn't have you. If you don't give your worship, he doesn't have it. But what does God value? What would really make him smile? I got here about 10 minutes before. And I've been here before, but to be frank, I don't remember. I mean, I remember being here, but I don't remember what I'm about to say. But in every church, there's somebody that gets there 30 minutes early. Is that, don't raise your hand. It'd sort of ruin it if you did, but don't raise your hand, right? Why do they do that? Because they're bored and they got nothing else? No. Because they're old and that's just, no. Why? They look forward to this all week. Excited about it. There are other people that come in 5 minutes after and leave 5 minutes early. Well, sometimes there's a reason for that. Some of that has to do with personality. You know, some of it has to do with responsibility. I'm not being critical of anybody. I'm just trying to make a point. Which one is God? I mean, God's here, right? This is worship. We're communing with God. He's here. When did God get here? Yeah, he's always here. So I don't know who said it. I heard it. That's true. God is omnipresent. But my judgment is that there is a special sense of God's presence in his worship. In other words, he's everywhere all the time, but he's with us in worship, right? Now, does God get here 5 minutes late, you think? No. I mean, he's looking forward to this all week. My children are coming to see me Sunday. I think God got here 30 minutes early, probably. He's like, I can't wait. They're going to sing me songs. I love to hear my children sing. They're going to study my word. They're going to ask me for things in prayer, and I can't wait to give it to them. They're going to remember my son and his death. God looks forward to worship. You say, well, that sounds good, preacher, but where do you get that out of the Bible? John 4, 23 and 24. The Father seeketh such to worship him. John 4, 23. God is the Spirit. Worshiping must worship in spirit and in truth. All right, this is all I'll be able to say because of our time. But I want, just because I'm not going to be able to elaborate, doesn't mean it's not important. So I hope that we'll all take this. When we come into God's worship, let's offer him extravagant worship. What does that mean? That means when I'm singing out. I'm meaning what I'm saying. That means when I'm praying, I'm really praying. I'm not thinking about what I'm doing when I leave. I'm focused on the prayer. That means when I'm taking the Lord's Supper, I'm not thinking, I bet this service is going to go over today. I'm thinking about Jesus' death for me. His body, his blood. When the sermon it's being preached. I'm not criticizing. Well, I think he missed a verb back there somewhere. I'm trying to say, I needed that. Don't ever listen to a sermon and not get anything out of it. Do you like to waste time? I don't. Don't waste time. At least get something out of every class and every... That's 200 somethings you learn a year if you're here for all the services, right? Get something. But most of the time we can get far more than one thing that we can take out there and say, I'm going to live like, I'm going to change that this week. I'm going to add that this week. I'm going to get something out of it. So what do we do in worship? You say, well, worship, that's passive. No, it isn't. Worship is active. Now, your body's passive, but your mind and your heart, they're going 100 miles an hour. Focused, listening, thinking, intending, loving, that's worship. So give God the extravagant gift of worship. This lesson has not been primarily about becoming a Christian. It's been to those of us who already are. But you could become a worshiper of God by becoming one of His children. He only accepts worship from His priests, His children. You could become one of those today by obeying the gospel. Maybe you've been studying with someone and you say, now I'm ready. I want to do it. So what do you need to do to obey the gospel? Well, after you believe that Jesus is the Son of God based on study, hearing the Word, turned away from sin, that's what the Bible calls repentance. Don't live a sinful life on purpose. Live for Jesus. Luke 13:3. Confess Christ with your mouth, which means to admit publicly what you've come to believe privately or in your heart. I believe Jesus Christ is the Son of God. Now, if you believe that, and only if you believe that, you could be baptized today for the remission of sins. Remission is not a word we use much. We just substitute forgiveness. Forgiveness. And then you can forgive yourself because God forgave you. I'll tell you, that's a good feeling. If you don't have that, you need that. But even more important than what you need, God gave His Son, left you a ticket to heaven. Have you picked it up yet? That's how you do it. You could be immersed in water for the forgiveness of your sins and begin a new life today. That's Acts 8:35 to 40. If you haven't been a faithful Christian, one of the reasons we have gospel meetings, we used to call them revivals, right? One reason we have gospel meetings and revivals is so people can be revived. They can get their lives right with God again. Maybe they've strayed a little. Maybe their energy's gone down. Maybe their sin's been encroaching on their righteousness. So this is an opportunity to change that. Push the devil away. Push the world away. Bring God in close again. How do I do that? Well, it might need to begin with a public confession of sin and say, I'm going to start over. I haven't done what I should have done, but I'm going to start now. And God lets us come home. Luke 15, James 5, 16. We'll pray with you at your request, and God will honor the prayer of a righteous man. And you can go home today with the assurance of a clean, pure record in God's book. If that sounds good to you, why don't you come while we stand together, while we sing.